To stay with what we've been doing, we're going to try to study the same thing they're studying downstairs, which is going to be Daniel 3. But I think it was a lot to cover with Daniel 2. May have been why my kids aren't covering Daniel 2 in the image there with all the different kingdoms and all. It'd be a really good study for us. And we're gonna look at it just briefly in Daniel 2, because I think, after reading some commentary on it and studying it a bit, I really think Daniel 2's context sets us up for Daniel 3, as far as maybe some of the reasoning behind the image and Nebuchadnezzar. That's something I'd never thought of before, but when we get to that, it's just an opinion. Y'all can look at it and see what you think. But we had Daniel 2, finishing up after Daniel 1, verse 19 says, "The king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. And for every matter of wisdom, understanding, both the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were within his realm." That says, Daniel continued into the first year of Cyrus the king. And if you also remember, in verse 17, it told us Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. So Daniel's prophetic abilities here made him really shine, above even those of this contemporary Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and those of Israel. So you have Nebuchadnezzar having this dream, and in chapter 2, he has the dream, and he asks them to interpret the dream, but he wasn't going to tell the dream. So that was the tricky part, is he designed this test to say, you really can interpret this dream and its prophetic nature, then you ought to be able to tell me the dream and interpret it. And man, how would you like to be one of the guys in that, trying to do that in that work? So yeah, that's pretty risky business when the king tells you to tell him his dream and interpret it. Of course, they kept saying, no, tell us the dream and we'll interpret it. Well, of course, we have God revealing the dream to Daniel, and Daniel providing the interpretation of it. So we see, verse 25 of chapter 2, it says, Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, I found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation of known to the king. And it says, the king answered and said to Daniel, his name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I've seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered before the king and said, as for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men, conjurers, magicians, diviners are able to declare it to the king. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar that which will take place in the latter days. This was your dream, and visions in your mind while on your bed. So we see Daniel gives all the glory, all the praise to God. He's not saying, look at me, I'm better than all these other guys. Instead, he says, it is God. God's given you the interpretation. He gave me the dream and the interpretation. Now through me, he's giving it to you. So we see that Daniel gave all glory to God. The part that was probably going to bug Nebuchadnezzar, he's relieved to finally get to hear the answer to his dream. But the part that's going to bother him is his legacy. And if you look at the kings of Egypt, and the king of Babylon, and the Assyrians, all these things, they wanted to be known generation or generations after. Why else would the kings of Egypt have built these great pyramids and had their image engraved and their name put on these things? Because they wanted to be known. And a lot of times, Egyptian pharaohs would come in there and they'd take somebody else's name off of it, put their name on it, their statue in place of theirs, and just basically claim on these pyramids as their own. They changed hands. So, but that, it was a big thing to them, not just the afterlife, but here on this earth, they wanted to be known and well known. And they wanted their kingdom to last forever. They wanted their descendants to rule their kingdom forever. And if you remember, in chapter 2, it says, let's start at verse 37, chapter 2. It says, you, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom of power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand, and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will rise another kingdom inferior to you, and another third kingdom of bronze will rule over all the earth. There will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, as much as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks into pieces, it will crush and break all things into pieces. And in that you saw feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, in as much as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. And as the toes of feet were partly iron and partly pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And if you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as iron is not combined with pottery. In the days of those kings, God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all those kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw a stone that was cut out of the mountain with hands, and it crushed the iron, the bronze, and the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. You see, right after this interpretation, Nebuchadnezzar falls on his face in verse 46. It did homage to Daniel and gave offers to present him an offering and a fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." And after that, he promoted Daniel in verse 48, gave him many great gifts, and made him a ruler of all the province of Babylon, the chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And then in verse 49, you see Daniel making a request to the king, says, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon, while Daniel was at the king's court. So here at the end of chapter 2, Daniel makes the dream known, and Nebuchadnezzar promotes him to pretty much the highest position, it sounds like, possible. And then Daniel looks out for his friends and asks that them be taken care of as well, and of course they are appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon. So they're all in very high standing with the king at this point. But if you use that as context into the next chapter 3 of Nebuchadnezzar building this golden image, the dream that Daniel gave him, the only part of that statue that he dreamed about, that he interpreted, was the head of gold. And here Nebuchadnezzar comes and he builds a complete statue of gold. Whether they're related, I don't know, but it's pretty interesting to me that within that context, Nebuchadnezzar is thinking he should be the kingdom to rule all kingdoms. If he's the head of gold, why not make a whole statue of gold and make it very big for everybody to see and everybody to worship, basically to glorify himself. You don't see him say that this is a statue of Baal. It doesn't tell us. Verse 1 says, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits, and set up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So this thing's about 90 foot tall, about 9 foot wide. I doubt it's solid gold, because that would have been lots and lots and lots of gold. Not that Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have had the amount of money to do it, he probably would have, but that, more than likely, it's cast and encoded in gold. Anyway, he sets up this gold statue for everyone to see, and regardless, let's say it is a god of Baal, or if it's an image of himself, regardless, he was wanting all of his nation to bow down to this one image. If you look a little background to the Babylonian Empire, at this time, Nebuchadnezzar II is who we're dealing with here. He was actually a Chaldean. And the Babylonian Empire was, you had the Arameans, the Chaldeans, and the Babylonians all in this one area. So sometimes they would take kings, would take and try to blend all them together and whatever their, you know, a lot of times you had conquering kingdoms over one or another. And they would try to unite them by having them all, you know, worship the same thing or go back to their roots. And Nebuchadnezzar is noted in history as rebuilding some of the old temple sites from before. So he wanted to strengthen them, encourage, you know, their religion and their false gods. And this may have been part of what he was doing here. Or, like I said, he may have actually had this image built of himself and have everybody bow down to it as well. We don't know. We just know it's a golden image. But like I said, after reading a little bit of commentary on the fact that Daniel's interpretation of his dream was they had to go with him, there's another empire going to come and crush his empire, another one going to crush that one, another one going to crush that one. It made sense to me that maybe he actually had this in mind, that he was going to make all people realize that he was the king. I don't know. What do y'all think? It could go either way. It could be a false god, or it could be him. We're not going to know the answer to that, but it was an interesting study anyway. Okay, so regardless of who this deity was, whether it was him or whether it failed, he kind of compensates and makes up for the fact that this is a non-living god by size. It's like, let's build it bigger and better than everything around, and everybody's going to realize how great and wonderful this god is. And you see, like I said, you see that in Egyptian kingdoms as well, trying to outdo each other and make, you know, their monument, death monument, whatever you call the pyramids, they make them bigger and better than everybody else's. Because some of the older pyramids are some of the smaller ones, and they got bigger and better and bigger and better, as, and it depends on the wealth of the nation too, how well they do in building something. So, well, let's go ahead and read about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because that's what we want to get to anyhow. If somebody would, let's see, Homer, you might read. Would you want to read the first 7 verses?
Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. His height was 60 cubits, his width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the councils, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps, administrators, governors, councils, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and the psaltery and the symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, and lyre, and symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up.
Okay. GM, you mind reading 8 through 12?
Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O kingdom, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach,
Thank you. Dave, you mind reading 19 through 25?
Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and special expression resulted before Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of the blaze of fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers and their coats and their caps and their other clothes and cast into the midst of the furnace. Blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace with the blazing fire still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astounded and stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, Was it not three men cast into the midst of the fire? Then replied the king, certainly, O king. And he said, look, for I see the 4 men loose and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of God.
Vince, do you want to read the rest of chapter 26 through the end?
Sure. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of the fire was not on them. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language that speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego should be cut to pieces, and their houses should be made an ash heap, because there is no other god who can deliver like this. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Okay, so now we'll go back to the beginning of the chapter, and we've discussed, you know, some of the possible motives of Nebuchadnezzar here in building this statue. Maybe to unite the kingdom, maybe to bring glory to himself, maybe bring glory to his false gods. Regardless, he's quickly forgotten the power of God. You know, in the last chapter after Daniel's dream, you know, he acknowledges the God of Daniel and says he's the God of gods and the Lord of kings. And then, you know, but I don't know the time span here. We're not given a timeline as to how long it took him to totally forget about the God of Daniel. But here he erects this image. And why do you think we got these other guys? In verse 8. Says, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. Why do you think these Chaldeans were bringing charges against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do you feel that they were truly devoted to the God of Nebuchadnezzar or this new image? Do you think that's the issue? Go ahead.
I think probably jealousy of the other people's position. And they were just trying to find some way to step up, move up the ladder. Move them 3 out of the way, and everybody else moves up a notch.
Right.
I think that's probably their biggest motivation.
I do too. Because here you have these 3 outsiders, 4 counting Daniel, and they just bumped right up the line. And now they have the king's ear, they have the power of the kingdom. And it's a dog-eat-dog world. The quicker they can get rid of somebody, then that means they may have a chance at promoting themselves.
Yeah. We can see from the text that the king, Nebuchadnezzar, he fought a lot of these men because he gave them the opportunity. He called them in there and asked them personally, you know, hey, is this true that you won't fall down? But he's willing to forgive them for that. You know, if you'll do it in the future, all that will be forgotten.
That's right. That's a good point. Oh, yeah. I haven't really thought about that, but yes, he did think a lot of them and gave them an opportunity to do so.
They see a little nationalistic pride here too, I think. They're right. Chaldeans. Nebuchadnezzar is a Chaldean. These are Jews.
Yeah.
And that kind of, you know, skip line because of Daniel. We know how the Jews felt toward other nations. And it could be these Chaldeans, especially sitting at the top of the ladder, looked down on everybody that was a Chaldean. You know, so it could have been jealousy, but it also could have been a nationalistic pride there too.
That's a good point.
Dave? I don't think those are stupidity on their part. Because if you go back, and I like the way you opened with John chapter 2 and 3, right? Because if you go back to that conversation that they're having in chapter 2 there, the king says, I know for certain that you're bargaining with not. He knows those guys. He knows how they work. Sure, I tell you, you tell me, yeah, we all get along, right? But the Chaldean king said, there's not a man on earth which is now setting up the power of God.
Right.
Daniel, of course, then goes and turns the and does all that stuff. And it could be in that pecking order that they're trying. Now you've got these three that are isolated from Daniel. And so they're thinking, perhaps, without Daniel around, maybe this is not such a spectacular set of people.
Sure.
It turns out, really, if you think about that statement those three made, that we don't even need them. You don't need to discuss the matter further, basically. We've made up our minds, even if we die, it doesn't matter, we're still not serving God. It's a huge state. And so it definitely had to be something where they just thought they were going to be okay by challenging. It sure wasn't intelligent.
Right. So where's Daniel? You mentioned that.
That's a question for the teacher. That's a question for the teacher.
So, I mean, I was going to address that, because it's always in the back of your mind. These three guys are going to the furnace. Where's their leader? Daniel.
Found him out, wasn't he?
No.
Daniel had been promoted to the position in the king's court.
Right.
They were probably scattered out, taking care of duties outside of the king.
That's kind of what I thought, because you in chapter 2 here, you have two distinct responsibilities, and that would mean they would be probably in two different locations. Daniel, like you said, as the head of the court, and they're just over the administration of the province. So Nebuchadnezzar called all these people from all the provinces that he ruled to come for this big celebration and to worship the image. I don't know why, you know, when the music went off and all that Daniel wasn't present for that. I don't know, but they clearly do have different responsibilities now and probably are working in different locations. But he was in the king's court, and maybe the king's court wasn't out there, you know, for the bow down. But we definitely know, like Zach said, we definitely know that Daniel wasn't there bowing down to the image. We just know from his character and him saying he was not going to defile himself with the food. If you look at the Ten Commandments, he was not going to worship a false god either. So I do not see that being an issue. Why he was absent at this time and at the point. It probably happened pretty quick. You know, the other Chaldeans, whatever, brought this accusation to these three. They came immediately to the king, and the judgment was handed down immediately. You're talking about a very large kingdom, and Daniel not being there in the presence, when you're talking about, you know, long journeys to get different places, I would think it was probably an urgent ordeal that it was handled pretty quickly. But, I don't know. Any other thoughts on where Daniel might have been? It's completely speculation.
He could have been out of family business.
Right.
He, like you said, he'd be over all these other objects. So he may have been out of town. We don't know. I mean, he could have been somewhere far enough away where he could get back in time at the beginning.
And you have these other guys, some of these that were accused in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they probably just traveled a good ways themselves, because it said every province. So they traveled a long ways at great expense to them just to follow the king's orders. And here you have these three guys that are right here and refusing to do so. There was jealousy involved and just anger. They were just mad all the way around.
In verse 49 of chapter 2, it tells us when Daniel requests the king, it says they was made, he sent Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So they wasn't too far away.
makes you wonder when Daniel was aware of it, you know, what would actually happen and all. But anyway, that's wasn't given to us through the inspired word. It's kind of fun to discuss or talk about. But anyway, I agree that Daniel was not present there being charged because he would not have bowed down to it. So we see the friends being accused, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I like the point that Tommy made, that King Nebuchadnezzar found favor in them, or even given them a second chance. I mean, he had plenty of witnesses that saw them not bow down to the enemy. That was enough to go ahead and have it killed. And it's interesting, though. You know, he sets this golden image up, and he lays down the law that anybody not bowing down to this image is going to be killed in a fiery furnace. Then they also kind of encourage the worship of this image with all the music and everything. We're going to make a big party. Yes, you're going to have to bow down to my golden image, but it's going to be a party and it's going to be fun. So he did kind of both. He threatened them with their lives, which everybody's going to show up. But at the same time, it was something that was probably appealing because it was a party. It sounds like to me. I think the music and all was at least an allure to them. More than likely, it was more than just music. More than likely, it was a drinking
festival.
That sounds like
some churches today. Alluring
people. Yeah. Right, right. And I imagine there was a lot of theatrics to this ordeal. I'd be surprised if there wasn't. So, verse 13, we kind of get to the meat of it all here in this little section, this paragraph that Jimmydale read for us. I like that, like I said, Nebuchadnezzar pretty much forgot the power of God. Or I guess he thought that God maybe had the power to prophesy and give, you know, interpret dreams and all that through Daniel. But when it comes to actual physical things on this earth, what power does he really have? After all, he just now conquered the kingdom of Israel, which is a great kingdom of Israel. You had the riches of Solomon, the armies of David, and he wiped them out. He's patting himself on the back. He has the best warriors. He has... When you look at Babylon and its greatness, of course, we're going to get to that next chapter. I'm not going to get into it. When you look at the glory of Babylon, I took a few notes years ago when Don Patton was here. It had the Hanging Gardens of the Babylonian Empire, which was basically an artificial mountain built, and these Hanging Gardens Nebuchadnezzar built. You had a reservoir that was 140-mile circumference. I read that. That's huge. That's 180 foot deep. The walls were 60 miles long. 60 miles long, 300 foot tall, 80 foot thick. That is an amazing, amazing complex. And if you remember when Don Patton was here, he showed us pictures of the ruins of Babylon and everything else. So Nebuchadnezzar feels pretty good about himself and pretty good about his kingdom. In his mind, he's going to be here forever. So in verse 15, but if you will not worship, you will immediately be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? So there he challenges God and their faith in God. He said, when I throw you in the furnace, there's nobody going to protect you, nobody's going to save you. The laws of nature are that you're going to be consumed by this flame, and you're going to be nothing but ash in a matter of minutes. Basically what he's telling them. And don't you love their response? Because if you think about this, like Tommy mentioned yesterday, for the Bible to refer to them as youths, they were going to be a pretty young age. We don't have that said exactly, but we're thinking probably early teens, you know, 12, early teens, mid-teens. When you think of David as a youth facing the lion, I think the same thing. And David facing Goliath as a youth, as a very young man. So that's one thing that we can't discount the youth as not being usable or workable or assets to the Lord's church and to God. Because you look through the history of the God's word, youths, young men, young women have been used for various things and very impactful. And look at the leadership of Daniel as a youth. Look at the leadership of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as youths. So, yes, dealing with children that age can be challenging at times. Sometimes they know more than you do. Sometimes they can have attitudes and different things. But at the same time, we have to remember that young people in the Lord's church are huge assets. Think of how many people they come in contact with every day that we don't see. Think of how impressionable that age group is to them, in people that they know, the people that they're with, and the impression that they can have on different ones. So that's just a side note here to remember how important the youth of the Lord's church really are.
They also bring vitality.
That's a good point. Just like this VBS, it makes you feel 10 years younger just being around these little ones. Now, y'all that have little young ones right now, y'all may not feel that way because they wear you out. But it just seeing them sing their songs and be around them and run around and visit and interact, it makes you feel younger. And like I said, that might be all it is. So we see...
Well,
yes?
Continuing on in the vein of the... youth can do it. Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 4 verse 12, he tells Timothy, let no man despise thou youth, but be thou an example of the word and conversation, charity and spirit and faith and integrity. So he's telling just because you're young doesn't mean you can't serve.
Right. And I think as adults, even as parents, as grandparents, sometimes we may not challenge our kids enough spiritually. They can do so much more than we give them credit for sometimes. So just keep encouraging, keep challenging them, because they can really do a lot in God's word.
When they complain, make them read the story.
What's that?
When they complain, make them read the story. You can pick up your room.
That's right. So, the part I really love, though, is their response to Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. I like that right off the bat. You know, we don't even need to answer. it's clear. You know, you have the witnesses. You know we didn't bow down. And you pretty much know we're not going to. Period. That's speaking very frankly to a king that can have you be dead or cast in the furnace. But it didn't matter. They weren't disrespectful, but they said, we are very sound in this belief and the actions we're taking, and we are not going. They were resolute. It says, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. So they made a very strong statement there that God was able to deliver. And then they said, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But, in verse 18, even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set. So, they told him, our God's able to deliver us. But if he doesn't, we're willing to die. We are going to die for our belief in God. And that was very, very, very impressive for these young men to take that kind of stand.
And one of the things I see standing out in this chapter, and chapter 1 as well, is faith. The faith that they had. I mean, they don't just say God's able to deliver us. They say he's going to deliver us. But then they tack on, even if he chooses not to, you know, we're not going to do it. But they say he is going to deliver us. And you see faith at the heart of that statement. They believe if they get cast in, they believe God's going to save them. And I think you also see that back in chapter 1 too. You know, it's not as explicit as it is here, but whenever Daniel proposes to test with the vegetables and water, like you pointed out, that is supernatural, because vegetables and water don't have that kind of impact upon one's health over that short period of time. But I think Daniel was doing that trusting God to take care of the details, if you will. I think you see faith in Daniel in chapter 1, God responds to that. I think you see faith in chapter 3, and God responds to that. And I think you see it in chapter 6 as well, but I'm not going to say anything about that since I'm going to teach chapter 6. but the point being, we need to have that kind of faith that says, although this doesn't seem clear to me, although this doesn't make sense to me, I'm going to trust in God, and God can deliver me. And if he doesn't, so what? But I'm going to demonstrate faith in the Lord. I'm not going to compromise, or I'm going to step out in faith. You know, I mean, there's just times in life where we may have to make a challenging decision, but we're going to trust in the Lord to give us the strength to do it. You know, and just, we don't know where it's going to come from. We just trust that he will. We act, and then God provides that. Because he provided it for them, he provided it for Daniel, and he provided it for us. So I think faith here really stands out to me.
That's a very good point. And that's something that definitely stands out, as faith in these three.
Hebrews 11:6, he is a rewarder of those who have faith, right? You know, God rewards us who diligently seek him. And I think you see the reward in Daniel 1 when he gives them. He answers Daniel's request, then he blesses him with wisdom. He gives him favor in the eyes of the eunuch. Here he rewards their faith by delivering them in the fire. I mean, he is rewarding the faith. He's the same God today. We just have to have the faith to take the big step out like what they did. And I don't think we always have that.
And you even see them being mentioned in the Hall of Faith that you talked about there in Hebrews 11, not specifically by name, but I think we all know that's who's being discussed. And Hebrews 11:32 says, "What more shall we say? For the time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire." There would be your Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. "Escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, and put foreign armies to fight." And it keeps on going. But that section there, the quenching the power of fire, I think clearly, because especially with the mouths of lions mentioned right before that, we'll talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Yeah. Do you have a comment, Dave?
Yeah, I think all that you're saying there, all that stuff is great too, and I think it's interesting that their minds could wrap around the idea that it doesn't matter if we die, we're still going to be delivered. So it doesn't matter to us. You may win this round, but we win ultimately with our deliverance from from in the afterlife, right?
Right.
We live with God forever. I don't know if they understood that. I don't know, but I think it's an interesting thought process that deliverance, we're going to be delivered.
One scripture I was going to mention, just you see some of the encouraging words of God. Isaiah 43, verses 1 and 2 says, "But now thus saith the Lord your Creator, O Jacob, who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I called you by name, you're mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers they will not overflow you. When you walk through fire, you will not be scorched, nor will the flame burn you, for I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior." So, just interesting there, the mentioning of the fire. But like Dave said, they were willing to die and ready to die at that point. And their faith in God, they believed they were fine. Whether they died or they didn't, it didn't matter to them. So, moving on in the chapter, we don't have much more time left, but I think part of this miracle, we always think of them being actually in the furnace, but that miracle started at the point they were being guided to the furnace. Because Nebuchadnezzar felt very strongly about this. You know, it says in verse 19, he was filled with wrath and his facial expression was altered. I mean, he is now grimacing, mad, furious. His face is probably beet red, and he's that mad at these three men who just, they made him look bad in front of everybody. They didn't do what he told them to do, even though he threatened them with death. And they said, whatever. you know, whatever you have to do, you do. You do your worst. And they stood right up to the king of Babylon, the strongest man in the complete world at that time, and said, you do your worst. And he's furious. And instead of just having their heads walked off, he's going to make an example of them. He already said he would have them thrown in the furnace, but let's make it worse. Let's make it 7 times hotter than it's ever been. And I'm also going to get my most valued warriors to stick them in the furnace. You know, they're in regular common clothes. The warriors, I would be surprised if they don't have some type of body armor on, whether it's leather. You know, if they're there guarding the king, they're going to have some type of protection on them. I doubt they're there in street clothes. And so imagine these warriors with some sort of, at least through the main part of their chest and torso and all, they're protected. Because if somebody challenges the king with a sword, they're there to fight. They're going to be, they're there in their work clothes, which is going to be at least some form of body armor either. So on the way to the furnace, these mighty men are engulfed in the flames. And here you had Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in nothing but their street clothes would have been consumed by the fire like that. They would have been on fire. And you know, they're still walking along, so the mighty men are still walking along with them. And I imagine, in my mind, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are being pushed toward the flame by these mighty men who had them bound. And therefore, they're closer to the flames than the mighty men. So we see the miracle of God starting already before they actually get tossed in the flame. And go ahead, Tom.
Well, I've always pictured it. I could make it wrong. In my mind, I always pictured there was some kind of ramp of fire. But in one place it says they fell into the flame. So I've always pictured it. And then, you know, the flames might not kill the mighty men, but just the heat coming off of it. You know, you get a big fire and it's incredibly hot just above it. You know, the flames may not be touching. So tree limbs and stuff will get scorched up there. But above it, the flames may not be touching. So they've been pushed across and then to be pushed in or off this ramp water, but into the end.
Right. And then we have the angel of God with them. They're loosed. And the amazing thing is when they come out, there's not a scorched hair on them and no smell of smoke. As far as the miracle of God there, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was thinking the rules of nature and laws of on this earth are the flames going to take care of them. But God went beyond that. He didn't even smell smoke on them when they came out of there. And it's just an amazing thing. Ben?
Talk about the part of God, all of the good, the creation of the universe, you know, but if it takes like that, it would be hard for us to grasp because it's just so infinite. The fire is something we understand. How many times have you went to put the steak on the grill and send some hair on your weapons and go back to the pan? And to be able to go into that kind of heat without having hair seen, not have any smell of smoke on it, no evidence that there were fire, that's something that we can understand. And I think because it's more intimate with us. And that is a fantastic example of the power of God. He has control over all the elements. Fire is nothing. Fire is like air to him. It's just a wonderful exhibition of the power of God on a level.
And after this miracle, we see again, change of heart of Nebuchadnezzar, as he says in verse 28, he responded and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. And he acknowledges that they gave up themselves, they gave up their own bodies to serve their God after that. So he acknowledges the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He says, therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb. Their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. And the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. So, you would think that would be the end of the story, that he would still humble himself before God, but we see in the next chapter, which we're not going to study, we see him glorifying himself on the walls of Babylon, looking out over his great country that we talked about, you know, the great walls and the great city and the hanging gardens and the reservoir and all these things that he's built. And he is the most powerful man in the world. You know, we watch all these movies about somebody wanting to take over the world. Well, that was nothing. He took over the world. Anything he wanted, he had. There was nobody stronger than him in the world. And he knew that, and it went back to his head again. And then he has another dream, and of course, Daniel interprets this one that he's going to graze like a cow, and he's going to be humble to the most humble state possible. You know, his hair is going to grow out, he's going to have talons, and he's going to eat grass. And he accepted it, and that's what became of him. And that would be the kind of the end of Nebuchadnezzar. We're probably not studying him anymore, because we have Belshazzar next at the end of the Babylonian Empire, and then you're going to have the Medes and Persians with theirs. So, appreciate your comments. Good luck.